Today on The Grave Talks, The Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, A Conversation with Brandi Butcher. The Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum is located in historic Weston, West Virginia. This National Historic Landmark served as a sanctuary for the mentally ill beginning in the mid-1800s. This 160-year-old asylum holds fascinating stories of Civil War raids, gold robbery, and the efforts of determined individuals to help better the lives of the mentally ill. It's also known as one of the most haunted places in the U.S. I'm Carol Hughes in for Tony Bruschi, and today on this episode of The Grave Talks, a conversation with Brandi Butcher, paranormal event manager at the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here today, Brandi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, first, I want to get right to the name of this building, Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. People might be offended by that, but that is the original name of the building.
Absolutely. And that is, there is a lot of controversy with it, but one of our main goals is to educate, you know, future generations about the brutal history of the past. And that was the historic name. So that's why we did adopt it when we opened up for tourism and education. So the historic name is the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, despite it not necessarily being, you know, PC.
Right. Because at the time, that's what it was built for, and that's what they named it. So you can't
Correct.
Really sugarcoat that at this point. Now, would you describe the building itself? If
sure.
If someone could see a picture of it, what would they be looking at? Because it's ginormous.
Yeah, a lot of people, even myself as a child, when you see it for the first time, your first impression is that it is a castle. It is massive hand-cut sandstone. We are 242,000 square feet of floor space, and lengthwise, we are only 25 feet short of a quarter mile. So this is all hand-cut sandstone, and it is just gorgeous. And like I said, first impression, most people think of a castle, and they actually brought German and Irish stonemasons in to help with the construction of the building because they were educated in working with these huge blocks of stone and building castles. So
when did the building begin? When did they start building it?
Construction began all the way back in 1858. And that was just, you know, groundbreaking, trying to get, you know, everything ready. And it wasn't very far into construction when the Civil War broke out. So what happened at that time is construction came to a complete halt. And because of the access roads, it made it a phenomenal location for Confederate and Union soldiers both to get war supplies in and out of that area. So it was actually taken over by soldiers, changed hands back and forth a couple times from the Union and the Confederate, and was known as Camp Tyler or Fort Tyler during the Civil War. So there is some extra history there that a lot of people don't realize besides just the hospital itself.
Now, when they built the hospital, it was built for people to, was it just for people who were mentally ill, or was it also a functioning hospital for illnesses?
Now, we do have a medical center that served as the community hospital for the surrounding town, but the asylum itself was meant to house the mentally ill, to help get them out of the poorhouses, out of, you know, maybe the jails, not to be an inconvenience to their family, because that's how a lot of people did perceive them, unfortunately, back then. So the building was built by Snowden Andrews, Richard Snowden Andrews, who was the architect behind it. But the Kirkbride design, or the Kirkbride plan, as some people call it, he was a doctor, and he believed that mental illness could be cured by beautiful surroundings, fresh air, sunlight, and mental and physical stimulation. So he wanted to build these very elaborate, luxurious, nice, basically nice hospitals / you know, homes for the mentally ill to go and be treated like human beings, have fair treatment, you know, nice, luxurious life, you know, and be treated like everybody else. It was meant to house 250 patients maximum. And, you know, with the size of that building, that seems like very few patients for such a large building.
Right.
And that was because they wanted each patient to have their own room, their own, you know, there are beautiful, luxurious day rooms in every ward so patients could go out, get these, you know, interactions, have music playing, you know, kind of, if you were a trusted patient, you could go out onto the grounds, what was called the Great Lawn. There's a beautiful fountain. There was a baseball field out there where the patients could go out and play or even watch other teams play. Very, very early, the local high schools would play their football and baseball games on the lawn. So patients could watch out the window and see, you know, keep score of the baseball games and things like that. There was also supposed to be, you know, just excellent treatment, no understaffing, any kind of, you know, the horrible treatments that did come along later, like the lobotomies and things like that. Like I said, 250 patients maximum, and that would have been ample space and plenty of, you know, attention for these patients. But when word did get out that there was this nice, beautiful hospital for these people, overcrowding became a very, very real problem. And it got to where there was anywhere between 24 and 2600 patients in the hospital at a time. So a lot of the horrible things that happened, aside from the treatments that, you know, they thought would actually cure mental illness, a lot of the incidents happened mainly because of understaffing and overcrowding. It wasn't necessarily that every, you know, staff worker, every nurse or doctor was some kind of, you know, mean, horrible person out to test on these patients or deliberately neglectful even, but they were completely overwhelmed with how many patients they had to care for versus what it was meant to be.
What year did they bring in their first patients then? How many years did it take them to complete that massive building?
Now, they actually brought patients in prior to the building being entirely completed. And the first 9 patients were brought in October of 1864. They were all women, all 9 of them, and they were all committed for domestic reasons. And what that means basically is that, of course, a lot of, and it comes up on our tours a lot of, you know, young ladies nowadays don't realize how far women's rights have come over the years. And in the very early days of the asylum, a man could bring a woman to the asylum, have her committed, sign her over to the state, and he walked away legally divorced, scot-free, and she was staying there for the rest of her life. So domestic reasons are, you know, basically if, you know, she may not have cleaned efficiently and or maybe had postpartum depression, things that we know so much about now, could have easily landed a female in the asylum in the very early years of early 1800s, 1900s.
And even if he didn't want to be married to her anymore, he could say anything about her. And she and women
exactly.
had no rights, you know, they didn't have any rights at that time in 1864.
Yep. And if there were children involved, he could bring the children with her and leave all of them there.
Okay. So Weston, West Virginia is where the facility is located. It doesn't sound like a really populated area. So maybe it is. Maybe you're close to what was a bigger city at that time. Where did all the patients come from then?
Yeah, and you're correct. It's not a heavily populated area. It's definitely not one of our bigger cities in West Virginia at all. Most people may not even know where Weston is if it wasn't, you know, for the asylum, even still to this day. But when they were bringing in these patients, there were other hospitals that would send them or bring them in on trains. So they would ship them in on the trains from either other hospitals or counties from all over the state. And of course, prior to one of the fascinating things about the asylum and the stonework on it is if you look at the outside of the building, it actually has the dogwood flower carved into the stone. And that is because when construction began, we were still the state of Virginia. So it was actually owned by the state of Virginia. However, it was the Civil War when we became our own state. And the gold that was placed in the bank of Weston at that time to help build the asylum was actually, the bank was raided. And by Colonel List, I believe was his name, came down, raided the bank and took the funds up north to add to the funds. Lincoln and the rest of the Union had gathered. And that is part of what funded West Virginia to become its own state. So when we did become our own state, and obviously at that point where the borders and everything were, the asylum was West Virginia, we had to pay all that money back to the state of Virginia later on.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because our state flower is actually the rhododendron, but the flower carved into the side of the building is the dogwood flower, because when construction began, we were the state of Virginia, and that is Virginia's state flower.
And I do think it's interesting that, you know, the original concept for this facility was that it would be, and at the time, that was kind of the idea that you could cure mental illness through giving them fresh air and maybe drinking from spring waters and things like that. It was a very simplified version of treating mental illness. I think there was some good ideas there, you know, fresh air and space, you know, can kind of help some people. But I do find it fascinating that that's the clientele they're trying to attract, people of more of means, I'm going to guess, and give them this nice facility for them to recover in and get better. But then they name it the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. Even at that time, I would think lunatic wouldn't be, if that's in the name of the place you're going, I wouldn't have a feel-good feeling about going there.
Right. And yeah, it's odd how, you know, how things are perceived now versus back then, because back then that was the standard term used, you know, so they even did. More common than, say, you know, crazy or out of your mind or any of those phrases. Lunatic was the standard phrase for someone that was, you know, had any kind of mental disability or, you know, illness, anything like that.
So you mentioned that in time, you know, it started out, I think, with good intent. There were good intentions all the way along. But when it kind of became overcrowded by, how many people did you say came in the thousands?
Yeah, anywhere between 24 to 2600 patients at a time. So, and and that was later on into the, like, the 1950s and the 1960s. So that was in the much later years. That was part of the reason that it ended up closing in the 90s, is it was just, and it was insufficient to heat and cool and, you know, just maintain at that point.
HVAC kind of changed over the years.
Right.
So how long did it operate as a facility with what they originally had in mind? You know, the nice space and bringing people in that I'm going to guess had more means to pay?
It was up until, really, it stayed fairly luxurious up until the 30s, 40s. It was a very slow decline as, you know, more patients were brought in and more space had to be utilized. So it was a slow downfall to the overcrowding because, like I said, our Ward 1, which is fully restored to replicate the 1920s, is extremely luxurious. And, you know, you can it shows just how nice these patients would have had it. It depended on what your mental capacity was, on where you were placed in the facility as well. So the building also has violent wards and criminally insane wards. So, you know, that's not me saying that in those early years, those wards would have been adorned as nicely. So those would have been a more high security ward, you know, maybe not had a nice chess table and a Victrola and things like that. So it did depend on the level of security of the ward on how luxurious that area was. So,
and it makes me think, too, that with the population of Weston, you know, finding employees to work at a place that massive had to have been really difficult for them to keep up with that.
Now, especially in the very, very early years, the entire fourth floor was actually used as staff housing. And the what I said earlier about having doctor's apartments and nurses' apartments, that staff would live right there in the building. They would sleep in shifts. And, you know, in some instances during some time periods, as one nurse was getting off with her shift and another one would get on, they would basically just trade spots in the bed type thing. She would go to work, she would get in the bed and sleep. And that's prior to automobiles becoming affordable. You know, people didn't have as such easy transportation back then. But because of the amount of staffing that was required, then that was one of the, at the time, solutions was having staff live right there on the property.
Which means you had no quality of life if you were an employee either, you know, because it's not like you could get away. You were there all the time.
Right.
Now, let's get into where it starts to get a little bit more darker. in the history, because I was reading that the hospital performed lobotomies and thousands of them in this hospital.
Right.
And this would have been, what time do you think, in what year do you think they started the lobotomies? Because it was a pretty brutal procedure.
I'm not positive of the exact year of when they started at our asylum, but as far as the procedure itself, and yes, it was definitely thousands that were performed there. It's probably the most brutal procedure of all of them. And there are several, you know, somewhat brutal procedures in a lot of people's opinions. Insulin shock therapy is definitely, you know, not anything pleasant. Hydroshock therapy, any of that stuff. But the lobotomy was, they believed, a quick fix, I guess you could say. And the theory was that by scrambling the frontal lobe of a patient's brain, that it would make them the ideal patient. They wouldn't have their fits of rage or their, you know, outbursts, things like that anymore. It was supposed to make them the ideal patient as far as they could feed themselves, clothe themselves, perform their daily functions, but not be any additional hassle for the staff, to put it in layman's terms, really. And what they did was they would take a tool resembling an ice pick, and they would put a small hole in your skull going behind your eye, and in a windshield wiper motion, scramble the frontal lobe of your brain. And like I said, that is what they, you know, said would make you the ideal patient. Now, what a lot of people refer to it as was the murdering of the soul. Because even though, you know, you may have, if a successful lobotomy, you could have performed these daily tasks like they, you know, expected you to do, but it zapped any kind of personality you had. You know, all of us have something that make us unique. We have our characteristics that make us who we are. And it essentially made you zombie-like, is the best way I can describe it. Even though you could perform these daily functions and, you know, maybe help kind of take care of yourself and, you know, exist without being an extra burden on the staff members, you weren't you anymore. There was nothing that made you
right.
Your own person.
And with that kind of treatment that they're giving to patients, these aren't patients that are going to be leaving. That, you know, I would think a lot of those patients live there. Once they came, they spent the rest of their lives there, I would
correct.
Think.
Correct. Even when the building did close and there was a facility that replaced us, and the patients that did remain, they were actually upset about leaving the original asylum, because that had been their home for so many years. They didn't care about heating and cooling in some nice new facility. You know, they didn't know anything but these walls of this asylum, and that was their home, and they didn't want to go to the new facility. There were tears. They were actually, you know, very upset and when they closed it and transferred the patients in 94. And there were 151 patients that were transferred to the new facility when we closed.
In 1994, it's quite a while ago, but not really. I mean, to be housed in a facility like that, when you look at it, it's just this massive building that looks like no one could have been in there for, you know, 75 years or longer.
Right.
And to think that somebody was, there are still people living there as late as 1994. That's
right.
Interesting to me. So when they closed down the facility, and was it that whole time called the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, or did they give it a friendlier name at some point?
No, when it was being used as an operational hospital, it was the Weston State Hospital.
Okay, that definitely sounds better.
Yeah.
It does. But so it closed in 1994, and then did it just sit there empty for a long time, or what was happening?
For a few years, yep. And then the state decided to auction it off because they couldn't, you know, decide what to do with it. There was, you know, different theories thrown around by, you know, all kinds of people. And then finally, when they decided to auction it off, the Jordans got in on it and made an offer, and they accepted. So they started slowly bringing it back by tourism. They asked for, you know, volunteers and basically people passionate about, you know, bringing this building back to life and letting people, you know, see all the historic and learn all the historic information that comes with it. So thanks to phenomenal volunteers and passionate owners, they were able to, you know, get it to what it is today.
Is the Jordan family local there in that area?
Yes. Yep.
Do you have any idea what they paid for it?
I honestly don't.
That would be interesting. Because the land alone, I mean, there has to be so much land that went with that.
There is not the 666 acres that seems to go around the rumor mill. We get that question a lot, and we do not have 666 acres. We do have almost most of the original property. We have all the buildings that came with it that are still functional. There are a few that had to be demolished just because by the times the Jordans got it, it, you know, just weather and wear and tear and stuff over the years from it sitting vacant. But we have 13 buildings still standing. That is accurate. And we have three cemeteries on the property. And that, you know, that alone says how many patient deaths there were, you know, at the asylum, having three cemeteries on the property.
Do you have an idea how many people are buried in those three cemeteries?
We don't. Our historian has researched for as long as I have known and as long as I've been there. And it's very hard to get an accurate number because especially in the early years, a lot of things were covered up and, you know, not right. just our facility, but lots of facilities back then. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to get an accurate number. There's also still a lot of privacy laws and a lot of things we don't have access to because of it being open until 94. But we know it is into the thousands. So.
Oh, wow. Well, and you think about it, a lot of those people were taken to the asylum, as we talked about, there was no reason to ever think they would leave. So they were kind of abandoned there.
Exactly. Or it was poor record keeping. And, you know, obviously pencil and paper doesn't last forever if it's not, you know,
right.
stored properly. So it either deteriorated or faded out, things like that. So it made it illegible.
So this brings me to my question of with thousands of people buried on the grounds. And then when you think about the horrible conditions some of those people had to have lived in and lived through. It couldn't have been this nice, beautiful, fun place to be. I would imagine that it's a very haunted facility. And I was reading it's one of the most haunted locations in the United States.
In my opinion, it absolutely is. There are a lot of locations I've not had the opportunity to visit, unfortunately. So I can't really give a firsthand comparison. But from what I've heard and from what I've experienced, I definitely put us up there with, you know, if not the haunted, then one of the most haunted. So,
well, and as a paranormal event manager, that's your title at the facility. Obviously, there are things going on to have you there with that sure. particular title. I think it's really interesting. So I want to, in our next episode, I really want to get into the hauntings of this facility. I just found the backstory to be fascinating. And I would recommend anybody jump online and Google Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum for some photos because it's impressive. And also, it is really scary looking at the same time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So we're going to follow up with that in part two. So this wraps up our conversation with Brandi Butcher, part one, paranormal event manager at the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. If you'd like to access all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts and you can try it for 3 days free or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and get everything there all ad free. For all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes. Thanks for listening.